In the nation's northwest corner is Washington, an evergreen playground blessed by an unusual variety of natural attractions.
Natural attractions. Here is our resident historian, Felix Bunnell, who joins us for All Over the Map, a quick look at the stories behind the names of local places. And this week, you are into microgeography.
Yes, of our Seattle World's Fair campuses. Two of them, because we've had two fairs in Seattle, the 1962 one at Seattle Center, but also that 1909 fair at the UW campus. And what's a little unusual about both of them is they were designed in such a way so when the fair was over, some of the infrastructure remained to serve the local population for decades afterward, or more than a century in some cases. But I don't want to talk about the obvious leftovers like the Space Needle or the monorail. Right. Everybody knows those stories. We'll get to those next week. I want to talk about some of the things that were only temporary and what's in their place now. Like, for instance, at where Bagley Wright Theater is on the north part of the Seattle Center, that was an open plaza called the International Mall. It was surrounded by a building with exhibits from Korea, India, United Nations, Thailand, and the Philippines. Here also was one end of the Union 76 Skyride. These were overhead cars.
I remember that.
Yeah. And the other end was over by the monorail station where EMP is now. Yeah. Now, the Skyride made its final run on September 30th, 1979. By the next year, it had been taken down and moved over to the Puyallup Fairgrounds. They had to make way for that theater. Now, there was a plan in 1979 at one point to keep part of the Skyride at the center and have it go all the way down Broad Street to Pier 70.
That would have been great.
And the city approved it and everything, but for some reason it fell through. That would have been very cool. They wanted, of course, a joint ticket on the monorail, the Skyride, and the waterfront streetcar.
Why not?
Now, that KCTS building on the corner of Mercer and Fifth, that part of the show fair was called Show Street, originally called Sin Street. It featured a number of adult attractions. Entertainer, entrepreneur Gracie Hansen had Paradise International, which was essentially a strip club. This is right, essentially the KCTS lobby was a strip club.
Okay.
And then another part of the KCTS building would have had, not the same building, they tore the buildings down and replaced them. There was something called the Girls of the Galaxy. I mean, use your imagination on that one. And another one called Peep Backstage USA.
Wow.
It's a lot of scantily clad was used a lot to describe these
things. I had no idea public television was into that.
Yeah, but it would be great for a pledge drive. Now, I used to work at KCTS. I figured out my desk is right where a thing called the Les Poupées de Paris was.
Really?
This was an adult-themed puppet show with, you guessed it, topless puppets. Mm-hmm. Produced by Sid and Marty Croft, who went on to do all those things like H.R. Puff and stuff and Sigmund and the Sea Monsters. All those things that Chris grew up on in the 70s.
Yeah. Wow. Did you find anything weird under your desk?
I didn't think about it at the time. Only later did I think, hey, wait, I think I was sitting right on top of the Poupée de Paris. Now, there's a big playground not too far from there that is on the side of the old Fun Forest. That was the amusement area that was put in after the fair. The name Fun Forest wasn't used during the fair. Now, this is a clip I want to play from the promotional record produced in 1962 by Pacific Northwest Bell, the old phone company. It's Carl Reiner interviewing Mel Brooks as a 2,000-year-old man.
Sir, did you go to the gateway here at the Seattle World's
Fair? Beg your pardon?
The amusement center here. Did you go to the Tunnel of Love?
Yes, I went alone. I came out married.
So the joke there is that the gateway was what they called the amusement park, and these knowing East Coast people, Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks, knew that name was a little odd even in 1962, where here we didn't. And the name dates to 1939. That's what they called the area at the San Francisco World's Fair was called the gateway. Same thing in Vancouver, B.C. Now, I want to get to one little part of the 1909 World's Fair, which is over on the UW campus, and there's nothing left. There's one grand building. The architecture building is the old Fine Arts Building. But the old amusement area there was along 15th, stretching across Pacific down to where the UW Hospital is. There's no evidence of it left, but it was called the Pay Streak, which was, you know, part of like when you're in mining and prospecting, the area where the rich ore is called the Pay Streak. Nothing left of that at all.
Not just a plaque, not anything?
There's one plaque about the AYP that's down near the geyser basin where the Drumheller Fountain is, but there's nothing that I've ever seen
so
that commemorates the
pastry. It's
not
nearly enough, in your opinion.
No.
Sounds like another crusade to me.
I'll get my shovel. Go down there and look for something.
Save the naked puppets, why don't you?
Yeah.
That's right. On this spot, there were naked puppets and Felix Bunnell's desk.
We could have plaques everywhere.
All of Felix's features are on MyNorthwest.com. You can text us anytime using the online Trading Academy text line at 98973, provided it does not distract you. Let's talk about the Seattle Police Department, which, of course, had to be reformed under Justice Department guidelines because of use of force, abuses, and other things, and has been trying to... We're trying to send the babysitter home, essentially, right?
Yes.
Okay. Hannah Scott is here, and we got close, But then there was a hitch because the union contract that the police officers abide by didn't seem to be in line with the Justice Department guidelines. So tell us where we stand.
And that's right. So the city was almost in the clear as far as the timeline goes to be clear of that consent decree. But back in May, Judge James Robart, who's been overseeing these Justice Department consent decree reforms since the beginning in 2012, found the city partly out of compliance specifically on the police accountability system in our city. And now, this was largely because of the new SPD contract, which, remember, took 4 years to get to, and the fact that it allows outside arbitration rather than a stronger city council-approved disciplinary appeals process, along with a handful of other issues, including a heightened and vague standard of proof of for discipline. There was some parameters around the 180-day timeline for imposing discipline that seemed to favor the cops. And there was also some restricted subpoena powers in that contract. All of those were concerns with the judge for the accountability system that SPD has. So he ordered the city to work with the federal monitor and the Citizens Police Commission, which was created as part of the consent decree, to come up with a plan to fix it. Last night, the mayor turned in that plan, and a lot of folks in the community are not happy with it. What it does is hires an outside consultants who will do a few things. They will do an assessment of our police accountability system in the city, and then also do a comparative study of, I think it's 20 other departments across the country to see how they do it. And then also do a kind of a deep dive into how those other departments' collective bargaining contracts and accountability work together, that kind of a thing. So the problem ends up being for community groups like the Citizens Police Commission and then some of the community groups who helped the city council get to the 2017 police accountability law that was passed, is that they say this rolls back the current contract, rolls back everything that they did, all the hard work they did for years to get there. Miguel Magestos with El Centro de la Raza said earlier this year that this is the city needed to quickly get back into accountability or risk further erosion of the public trust.
We are tired and frustrated that promises to fix the broken accountability system have not been met. And we know that our community's trust is at stake.
And Councilmember Lorena Gonzalez had that same concern when she made it clear last month that the council was worried about the mayor's plan that she just unveiled.
Listen, I'm sure that these folks are very qualified and that they understand the work that they are doing. But they are not from Seattle and they are not rooted in community. And it is important for us to make sure that the work that has been completed by both this city council and the Community Police Commission is respected. We know what is wrong with this accountability system. That is exactly why we advanced the accountability ordinance that was unanimously passed and signed by the mayor in 2017.
And Gonzalez made those remarks outside the federal courthouse last month when the originally the plan was supposed to be due and they asked for an extension. But she and a couple of other members on the council had urged the mayor, along with several community groups, to ask the police union to reopen that four-year contract to see if they could address those specific issues that the judge had and change them. And the mayor has not made that request.
Okay, this all gets very technical, but I think what people are concerned about is, well, a couple of things. Of course, you don't want the police abusing use of force. But we haven't had instance in a while, have we?
No.
So we haven't had an instance in a while. So it sounds like something has indeed changed. And the other thing is police department morale, which we hear from time to time complaints saying we're not supported. And, of course, in New York City, you've seen what's going on there. It's gotten to the point where the, shall we say, the not-so-nice people just dump water on them knowing they can't respond in any way. And you don't want to get to a situation like that because that anarchy does not work.
No. Absolutely not. And absolutely, police morale is a concern. But on the other side, you're going to have the community saying community trust is an equal concern.
Yes.
So that's kind of the dilemma. The bottom line is the city needs to get out from underneath this consent decree forever, which already the fact that they were found out of compliance on accountability tripped up the clock that was going to get them out of that. But the other thing I want to point out is in the mayor's plan to the judge that was just filed, she is focusing on the fact that they are about to open the next round of contract talks with the police union because the contract expires, I believe, at the end of next year.
Yeah. Do they do more things like recruiting from the community now to get officers? I mean, there seems to be They have such a hard time getting people.
I think
who
they
do
recruit from wherever they possibly can because SPD continues to lose officers. Morale is an issue. This consent decree and ongoing.
But to create trust, you have to have. It's great when the kid you grew up with in high school, you know, becomes a cop and you know him and you trust him.
Yeah.
Or her. And there needs to be a way to get that done.
There needs to be a way. And look, this is not just a problem for Seattle, if we're talking about the problem of recruiting and getting new officers.
Yeah.
It's a problem in several departments across the country. There is an issue with trust for both police officers and community members across the country in a lot of large departments. It's specific here in Seattle to do with the excessive force situations we had seen in the past years ago. And there has definitely been improvement over the years with the accountability system, with the consent decree reforms. But you've got to get past this one particular thing in order to really get the community members and the city on the same page with the police and hopefully get morale back where it should be.
Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Cairo film critic Tom Tiny is back, and so are sweeping shots of the Space Needle and exaggerations about how much rain we get. It's another Seattle movie based on a Seattle novel, but filmed primarily in Seattle's twin city of, no, not Vancouver. This time, it's Pittsburgh. What looks more like Seattle than a landlocked city on a river than Pittsburgh?
It's on three rivers.
On three rivers, that's right.
Name them.
Sure. The hilarious.
The Monongahela,
the Ohio, and what's the last one?
I don't know.
I can't remember.
Delaware?
No, it's not that one. Uh-huh. Sorry.
Anyway,
I'm glad we brought that up.
Yeah, Monongahela is just the one I was going for.
Here's Tom Tiny.
So, sure, the hilarious comic novel Where'd You Go, Bernadette by Seattle writer Maria Semple has been turned into a movie. But I think they should have tweaked the film title a bit to Where'd the Funny Go, Bernadette? The funniest novel I've read since Nick Hornby's High Fidelity plays on the big screen like a far too earnest and psychologically explicit family drama. Now, it's not that serious stuff isn't in the novel. It's just that it's allowed to sneak up on you and has a bigger impact as a result. Take away the book's humor and satire, and you lose a major reason Semple had a runaway bestseller. Now, the character Bernadette, played brilliantly, by the way, by Kate Blanchett, who's always brilliant. She's a wife and a mother and a one-time architect, and she's the source of much of this humor. Her wit and biting sarcasm immediately endear her to the reader as she mercilessly skewers the inanities of contemporary living. Now, although she's snobbish and quite full of herself, she's also overwhelmed just enough by the demands of daily life. Her house is a mess. She can't stand small talk socializing. That she comes off as mostly relatable. And author Semple surrounds her with comically insufferable and provincial Seattleites so that you can't help but root for her. Whenever you're not laughing with Bernadette, you're no doubt laughing at her ridiculous neighbors, school parents, everybody else. Now, once the laughs and the rooting interests are firmly established, the reader slowly begins to see the cracks in Bernadette's facade. Unfortunately, famed director Richard Linklater dispenses with much of the humor and immediately starts picking away at the cracks. The wacky antagonists in Bernadette's life are toned down, and so not as funny, and that makes Bernadette's sarcasm come off more as bitter than witty. It's clear that Linklater was more drawn to the emotional side of the novel than the comic side. And if you were that rare reader who wished for a clearer, simpler through line in the novel, you might even appreciate Linklater's streamlining. Now, I fully acknowledge the book makes for a tricky cinematic transition because of its epistolary nature. It's made up of a compilation of email chains, social media dictations, book reports, police reports, doctor's reports, and good old-fashioned letters. Much of the fun is trying to read between the lines of the various writers of said writings. By taking Bernadette and her problems too seriously, too quickly, Linklater strips his heroine of so much of her personality. Thematically, he makes baldly explicit what's mostly implicit in the book, Bernadette's evolving state of mind. It's as if he's taken a narrative shortcut by making the subtext the actual text, which robs it of much of its emotional power. Where Do You Go, Bernadette is not meant to be and can't support a deep dive into character psychology. It's better viewed as a comedy of manners, full of rich insights into character and family dynamics. It should be embraced as a kind of 21st century Jane Austen novel. Instead, Linklater inadvertently reduces it to a rather perfunctory self-help book, and that's not funny.
Hmm. But at least part of it was filmed here, right?
That's
right.
Was
it filmed down the street?
It was. There is a shot of her at the Seattle Public Library because she's an architect, so she loves the Rem Koolhaas Library. I think there's a shot down maybe in Belltown, and there's a shot, airline shot of the Space Needle.
And the rest of it in Pittsburgh.
And the rest of it in Pittsburgh.
By the way, the Mongahela Allegheny and Ohio River.
It was the Allegheny.
Yes, yeah. Okay.
There you go.
I'll look that up for you. That's what I do.
Thank you. Anyway. So, how many tangs for Where'd You Go, Bernadette?
I'm really disappointed because I love the book. I'm giving it 2 out of 4.
All right. That's it, Bernadette.
Sorry. Go back to Seattle.
Thank you, Tom.
Bye-bye.
Two childhood friends are turning recycled bouquets into moments of joy. CBS's Adriana Diaz has your daily dose of kindness.
Hey, Meadow.
Hi.
I brought you some flowers.
Oh, thank you. Boy, those are beautiful.
Bloomington, Minnesota is in full bloom. That's where you might call Karen Wooldridge and Laura Hogan full-time flower girls.
Hi, Maxine.
An idea sprouted between the longtime friends early last year. Take unsold flowers destined for the dumpster, repurpose and deliver them to those who could use an extra visit. Seniors. The flowers deliver a special feeling that inspires both song and dance.
Well, I took dancing.
I can tell.
Yeah.
You're good.
We started working on our kitchen island, and we were really proud of delivering a dozen or two dozen flowers.
Then what happened?
What happened, Laura?
We bloomed. Bloomed is what we say.
Now, they rearrange nearly 1,000 bouquets a month with 150 volunteers working 5 days a week.
Maybe just the hydrangea.
This is Bluebirds and Blooms, named after the Paris childhood youth troupe, the Bluebirds.
They're ready.
Okay. The flowers brighten 30 communities.
It kind of opens a conversation. It opens a door.
Mostly homes for seniors with memory loss, like the Wellshire.
This is for you. Beautiful.
I'm not used to this.
Velly Larson has dementia. Some memories may have faded, but her daughter Karen Schwartz was in the same Bluebird troupe as Wooldridge and Hogan, and Velly taught them all music.
What did you think when they gave you the flowers today?
I just was in shock, and I thought, why? Why would they give me flowers?
I think they just wanted you to have something nice.
But, believe me, I took them real fast, and they're not getting them back.
When they deliver flowers to her, she'll call, she'll describe them to me, and give me a flower report every day.
The flowers are also a reminder that someone cares, even if the memory of who has gone, says the center's director of life enrichment, Cheryl Hassan.
That was pretty special. I know it was.
They're confused and sad, and just to have such a simple thing as a bouquet of flowers just brightens their day. Families will come in and they'll say, oh, who got you flowers? This is beautiful. And it says, thinking of you. So the resident can just say, oh, somebody was thinking of me.
So if you pluck off all the little guys.
For Wooldridge, the act of kindness brings back fond memories of her father, who had Alzheimer's.
I know he would have loved visits from these women, he would have called them girls, coming in with a bouquet of flowers. It would have made his day.
What do you think your father's thinking of what you're doing right now?
Oh, gosh, I haven't thought of that, but he would be so proud.
Is it ever difficult doing this kind of work? You're with people who are struggling with memory loss, and you're with them every day, almost. Does it weigh on you?
It's happy to us. It's doing something good. On Tuesday, a woman said to me, you've made my day. And I just looked at her and said, well, you've made my day.
Returning the favor with flowers.
Once again, such a simple idea, but such a big impact.
Yeah. And music helps, too, for Alzheimer's patients. Because people remember those songs that they learned as kids.
Yeah.
And will sing along and have a great time. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com. 7:47 is time for our Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And here he is, Danny O'Neill. Seahawks are off to Minnesota for their second preseason game of the year. Russell Wilson won't play, and now we know why. The Eagles have lost two quarterbacks to injuries. Season hasn't even started. I'm wondering, I'm talking about, who was it, Cody?
Cody Kessler suffered a concussion.
Yeah. Now, do other will other teams use these preseason games to deliberately try to knock a quarterback out of the game?
That's never happened, Dave.
Okay. Phew. Are you being sarcastic?
Well, no. They don't. I wouldn't say the idea of knocking a player out of a game is different than the idea of hurting a player. I don't think people in the NFL, players, and this is honestly, there's not people that are going out there trying to injure someone. They're trying to hit someone as hard as they possibly can. So it might sound contradictory to say, but no, there's no extra targeting. If anything, quarterbacks have become so much more protected in today's NFL that defensive players are trying to avoid hitting them in ways that will result in penalties and fines, because you can't hit a quarterback in the head. It's the only position where there is an entire rule that is you can't strike him in his head. If you slap his helmet when you're trying to pass rush him, it's a penalty. So they've done a lot to protect quarterbacks. At the same time, the quarterback is the most likely player to fumble the ball. Of anybody carrying the ball when he has it, he's the most likely because he's not always prepared to get hit. When a running back has the ball, almost always they are anticipating a hit. Right. But no, I don't think there's any targeting going on. Carson Wentz has been banged up throughout his career, and he's a promising young quarterback the Eagles have. And they've held him out of the two preseason games. But no, I don't. I think it's more Russell Wilson not playing is about the lack of upside more than the risk. What do you gain from that? And I think he will play some this week. We'll see. But I think that we'll see him out there. But the game, what's he going to gain? He's ready for the season.
We already know he's good. Question for you. Packers quarterback Aaron Rodgers thinks that maybe if the beer prices were lower, the crowd will get louder. What's up with our fans? Seahawks fans don't need to be, you know, tipping one back to be loud.
Well, I don't know about that.
Lately?
I don't think there's...
I'm the loudest person in the room. My sons banned me from watching Seahawks games because mom goes into beast mode and I don't need any.
Well, that's good.
Anything to drink.
We need more of that. Do I think that there's a correlation between crowd behavior and beer? Yes. Do I think it's necessarily about volume? No. I do think that fans would like beer. This is going to be an unpopular opinion, and it comes from someone who no longer drinks, so that might bias me.
Okay.
I think high beer prices actually creates some level of moderation that might not otherwise be there. And I have never gone to an NFL game and think, you know what? There's not enough drunk people here. People should be more well lubricated than they actually are. I've never felt
my point exactly.
I've never felt that there was a lack of beer, even given the beer prices. Now, on behalf of my former self who did drink before, I probably would have enjoyed lower beer prices, then it would have allowed me to enjoy a few more frosty beverages. Do I think that actually impacts the level of noise from the crowd? Not really, because most people, when they get to a certain point of drunkenness, aren't able to coordinate their sound, the loudness in time and make the focus of it as you should. Because it takes a skill to effectively use noise at a football game.
Absolutely.
You do it in anticipation of the opponent's snap. You're not doing it when your offense has the ball. Like, yeah, it takes a little bit of discipline and a little bit of control. And people that have been overserved, so to speak, don't always possess that.
Maybe Rodgers just wants to make more friends.
It's possible. Also, Aaron Rodgers might be responding to the fact that he was seen on a big screen chugging beer and he was terrible at it. Absolutely awful.
Oh, no.
Then made some sort of reference of like, if it was drinking scotch, it'd be an entirely different matter. Okay, big snob can't chug a beer.
That's what's behind this?
Yeah, well, I just thought, so that's what I think.
I think his beer cred?
I think so. He lost it, man. Anybody that watched it, one of his linemen slugged it down. Kristen Yelich, who's a great player for the Brewers, slugged it down, and then here's like, oh, am I going to take a little sip? I don't want to choke. I'm going to be like, oh, let me just tip it back. Okay, is that enough? Not even half done.
Snowflake.
Pathetic.
Did he pour it into a shot glass?
No, he didn't. That would have been even worse. Maybe if he'd done the Century Club, then we'd be talking.
Okay, stealing signs at the Little League World Series.
Ooh, this is a good one.
Explain how that's done.
Well, it's done by the runner on second looking
well,
in.
So you first have to have a runner on second.
Yeah, you have to have a runner in position to see the catcher signs.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, this is standard stuff in Major League Baseball. It's why you'll see when there's a runner on second, there's an elaborate, sometimes it's not even anymore putting down a number, but it used to be when you had a pitcher on the mound, you could see what the catcher was signaling if no one was on base. It was a one for a fastball, two for a curve. Like that was standard stuff. It's become more complicated now, especially because Major League teams think that everybody's stealing signs. In Little League Baseball, it's forbidden. You are not allowed, and the players, if a player cannot see a sign and relay what that sign is to the hitter, it's against the rules. And they're saying that the little scamps from Rhode Island, the little scamps, the scofflaws, the reckless kids from Rhode Island had a complex series of signs that they would use for the runner on second to communicate to the batter exactly what was coming.
See, I think that might be one of the motivations to get to train more players to hit doubles. Because there'd be an additional advantage to having a player on second.
The whole thing,
An informant.
Yes, but here's the thing is that it's really easy to use a different code of signs.
Oh,
like the idea and thinking that you know a sign is worse than not knowing what's coming. Thinking that you know what's coming and then getting something different is way worse than not.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's the way to fight it. So it becomes another game within a game. You know, like the pitcher batter duel. It's the game within a game. The catcher second base runner duel.
I like to think back to my 12-year-old self and how would I have responded to someone stealing signs? I would have loved to have a more elaborate sign system. Like, hey, we think these guys are stealing signs.
Yeah.
Let's try and double And so instead of whining to the officials to like stop them from stealing signs, make your kids smarter.
You have the right idea.
Or you could allow them to lead off finally, because that would give the runner on second base a little more to think about.
That's
true. Because the pitcher could turn on him, but you can't lead off until after your 12-year-old.
I think we finally fixed baseball this morning.
I would also say as a 12-year-old, if you told me I couldn't steal signs.
I'd totally steal signs. Come on, I coached Little League for 11 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is sign stealing unusual?
No, we do it all the time.
Sports Insider is brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Thanks, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
And this hour of Seattle's Morning News is brought to you by Wilcox Family Farms. Coming up,
affordable housing is an issue that's gone neglected for far too long.
Anna Scott will tell us what two members of Congress and three local mayors plan to do about it. Rachel Bell takes us to a local Spanish language immersion cafe. And in a few minutes, I will ask Women's Compline Choir director Rebecca Gilmore about her latest performance. How did the crowd react? Did they clap?
No, actually, it was better than that. They were absolutely silent.
Silent. Right. First, though, some Washington healthcare providers are speaking out against a new federal policy restricting legal immigration. President Trump says the updated public charge rules will save taxpayers money by ensuring immigrants are self-sufficient, but opponents say it may actually cost more in the long run. Here's Cairo Radio's Aaron Granillo.
Yeah, and just to recap here, the public charge rule has been around a long time, barring immigrants from gaining access to the country if they are likely to depend on certain government services like cash assistance or long-term care. The administration's rule change broadens the scope, now saying people who rely on programs like Medicaid or food stamps will be less likely to enter the country or stay in the U.S.
We are dismayed and concerned.
So this is Chris Casa, and he's a policy analyst with the Washington Association for Community Health, operates about 300 clinics around the states. Many serve low-income immigrant citizens, and he is worried some may drop out of these social programs that they are legally entitled to.
We do observe this chilling effect. Folks who are not clear on the details of this extremely complicated new rule, who figure that it's better to be safe than sorry and forego some of the help that they need and would be entitled to.
And there is evidence now that this is already happening across the country, including at Seattle's International Community Health Services. Aliyah Hawk is their nutrition services supervisor.
I actually see the effect of it firsthand. I had a lot of patients coming and asking us to remove them because they just didn't want anything that they're doing for immigration to be affected. Remove all the whole family from all medical, dental, and everything. A dad literally begged me to do that.
And she shared another story about a woman who qualified for Medicaid but instead opted to pay cash for her daughter's medical needs because she feared using public benefits would work against her when she applies for a permanent legal status. Now, supporters of the new public charge rule say they understand this may put low-income immigrants into tough spots, but ultimately they want people who come to this country to not rely on social services.
Through the public charge rule, President Trump's administration is reinforcing the ideals of self-sufficiency and personal responsibility.
That's Ken Cuccinelli, and he's head of the U.S. Citizens and Immigration Services, announcing the policy earlier this week. He says immigrants who receive one or more public benefits, even in the short term, may be denied entry or a green card. And he says this will ultimately save taxpayers money.
The benefit to taxpayers is a long-term benefit of seeking to ensure that our immigration system is bringing people to join us as American citizens, as legal permanent residents first, who can stand on their own two feet.
But critics say that's actually just a red herring. They argue because some immigrants, like we heard, will drop out of certain social programs, that they'll turn to other sources, like state-funded emergency rooms, for instance. Here's Alia Haq again.
Pregnant women will probably prefer not to see the doctor. And then I fear that they'll have babies at home, and if they can run into problems. There will be unimmunized kids out in the community. So sick kids, basically.
And this is also one of the arguments we're hearing from Washington Attorney General Bob Ferguson.
Frankly, this public charge rule forces legally present immigrant families into a terrible choice. Either continue their dream to become Americans or provide health care, food, or a roof over their children's heads. That's not a choice anyone should have to make.
And Ferguson is now leading a coalition of 13 states. He's suing the administration over this policy. He calls it un-American, anti-immigrants, and unlawful.
So these are immigrants who, you, as you say, are here legally.
Correct.
They have their documents. They're legally entitled to work here. Mm-hmm. And the purpose of this program, I get, well, whether it's the purpose or not, the effect has been to scare them away from using services that they may need if they're temporarily out of work, for example.
There is anecdotal evidence for that. I was looking for specific numbers of people, the number of people who are legally entitled to certain programs and who are dropping out. We can't get that data necessarily because these community health clinics don't ask for your legal status when you come in for assistance. So it's hard to say how many people are dropping out. But again, talking to a number of different low-income health clinics, it seems like people are coming in and they're fearful that if they still rely on programs like food stamps and like Medicaid, that, that will work against them when they apply to become legal residents.
Now, are these health clinics privately funded? Or so in other words, they would go to these clinics hoping to use a government program to pay for them?
Correct.
I see. Okay.
Looking for Medicaid,
It sounds like one of these ideas that's meant to deter immigrants from coming across the border, but any idea whether or not it'll work? I mean, we were separating families at the border, and that didn't seem to deter people.
So what's interesting here is that this is really the first, I think it's the first policy that's really been targeting legal immigration, right? Because, again, these are people who are trying to do it the right way, and who just essentially they aren't making enough, or they don't.
A lot of them are working.
They
right?
are working, or maybe and they're in low income jobs, or maybe they don't get health care, for instance. So they have to rely on Medicaid. The policy says that if you rely on social services for, and this gets a little wonky here, so bear with me for a second, for 12 months within a 36 month period, then that may work against you.
Let me anticipate one of the arguments, some of the pushback. It's going to be the reason these clinics are complaining is because these immigrants are a source of their funding, of their income, right?
Yeah, that's a fair point. Yeah, absolutely, Dave. And that's what you hear from the other side, too, is that, I mean, this is a drain on our economy. A number of people who are trying to become citizens are relying on taxpayer money. Yeah. We don't want that to happen. That is absolutely one of the arguments from their side.
But if they're turning up at the ER, we are paying for it anyway.
Right, right. So like a lot of immigration issues,
it's complicated.
It's complicated,
Aaron Granillo, thank you, Aaron.
Yeah.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Heather Bosch, who's in for Colleen O'Brien. If you've lived in Seattle for any length and listened to King FM, you know that on Sunday evenings, they broadcast live from St. Mark's Cathedral what's called the Compline Service, which is traditionally the last monastic office of the day, right? It's a sung prayer, essentially. And it's always sung by men. Or at least it was until last Sunday, when for the first time, the Women's Compline Choir sang the ceremony. And Rebecca Gilmore is director of the Women's Compline Choir. We can describe this as a blow for women's equality, right?
Of course.
I don't want to politicize a religious matter like this, but why has it taken so long for there to be a Women's Compline Choir?
Well, I think it's important first to say that women have been singing the service of Compline for well over 1,000 years. It's just that the Compline Choir at St. Mark's has been only men since it was started about 63 years ago.
So an arbitrary twist of fate is what you're saying.
Yeah, the founder of the Compline Choir, Dr. Peter Halleck, gathered a group of people that were close to him that happened to be men, and they decided they wanted to pray this service together. Mm-hmm. Initially, it was not something that was attended by other people. It was only attended by the people singing it. And that, over time, has had such a following that it just became an iconic part of the worship life at St. Mark's.
As I understand it, I've been there once, and it was packed.
Yes.
I mean, it's for something that happens at, 9:30 on a Sunday night?
Mm-hmm.
To be able to fill a church the size of St. Mark's is a pretty remarkable achievement.
It's true. And I think the character of the service is different from what people are necessarily accustomed to in worship services. So people come and they bring their sleeping bags or their pillows and they spread out on the cathedral, laid on the floor, looking up at the ceiling, and can have quiet time just with themselves as they listen mm-hmm. to this beautiful music being sung. We offer sort of a safe space for them wherever they're at.
It is perfect for contemplation, and everybody's welcome. It's not any particular religion. Anybody can come.
Right? Absolutely.
So what did it take to put together this choir then?
Well, about 3 years ago, the current director of the Compline Choir, Dr. Jason Anderson, was putting together a tour to England for the men's choir. They're in residence at Canterbury Cathedral this week, and then next week they'll be in residence at Salisbury Cathedral. And Jason said this is a perfect opportunity for women to finally have a chance to sing the service at St. Mark's. And so he offered to let me be the conductor and to put mm-hmm. together a wonderful ensemble. It's made up of church musicians and music educators and professional singers, as well as singers who are part of the worship life of St. Mark's regularly.
In other words, it took the men traveling to Europe to get you the chance to do this.
Well, they are very committed as a choir. They're there every Sunday night at 9:30, no matter what, the only exception being when Sundays fall on Christmas Eve, and mm-hmm. then they have one night off.
So is this just a one-off, or I guess a three-off? You're doing it three times. When the men return from their tour, they will take over again?
Well, I will tell you that there's been a great deal of positive feedback about the women singing. The men, this is primarily their service, but the women, I have little doubt, will be invited back at different times in the future.
So did you have to learn this from scratch?
Yes, though so many of us that are singing this service have attended Compline over the decades, and mm-hmm. we have generations of women who are singing this time that have learned the language, learned the cadence, and have been waiting for the chance to get to sing.
When women sang it for the first time, how did the crowd react? Did they clap?
No. Actually, it was better than that. They were absolutely silent.
I see. Well, I guess that's good. Do you think that there ought to be a rotation, or is it allowed to have a co-ed Compline Choir?
Oh, all of those things are possible, and all of those things are practiced around the nation and around the world. At St. Mark's, we have 7 choirs that regularly offer their singing in services, and 6 of those 7 are men and women together. And so I certainly don't begrudge the Compline Choir the very special experience of being together as a men's ensemble, just like I hope they don't begrudge us being together as a group of women. It's, of course, possible that we would be singing this service, but I think everyone loves the timbre of men's voices in that service, too. And so I, for one, hope that they do continue to sing, knowing that we'll be welcomed at different times.
You don't seem militant at all about this.
Oh, no, no, because it's such a special offering that they give.
Yeah.
And I have found great solace myself sitting there on the floor. And so I'm so excited that I'm part of a church that's as progressive as St. Mark's Cathedral is and that integrates women into the worship life as it does. But because we're so progressive, I can be very welcoming towards this one example of men gathering and singing.
Yeah, St. Mark's is known as a very progressive parish. You have how many women priests now?
We have 3 women priests out of 4.
So you would think that you would be more militant about saying, you know, after so many years of the men have been doing it for 60 years, maybe it's time for women to do it for 60 more years, the next 60 years. And you don't feel that way.
No, I don't. As a matter of fact, this tradition that was started by Peter Halleck undergirds the wonderful music program that we have and to some degree the worship tradition that we have. So we're filled with gratitude for what Peter Halleck has offered, and as well as the way that he has set up this choir, and it has functioned, bringing so many people into our building each week.
Mm-hmm. I know that in many churches, women feel marginalized, but you don't, even though you are only doing it 3 times, you don't feel marginalized.
I don't, because we have so many opportunities to offer our voices there at St. Mark's. And if a group of women wanted to sing a Compline service every week, that would be something that the church would be open to, if the women are willing to commit to every single week, no matter what.
Well, there's that. Plus, you're married to one of the male singers. I am.
I'm married to one of their countertenors.
What's it like living with a countertenor? I mean, a countertenor pretty much has the same range you do, right?
I have a higher range than he does.
Very good. Rebecca Gilmore is the director of the Women's Compline Choir. Their next performance is going to be August 18th, then again August 25th, 9:30 p.m. at St. Mark's Cathedral. Rebecca, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.